I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania has a reputation for being a battleground state, and it looks like it could play that role on April 24th when it has its primary. If Republican Rick Santorum can't win the state he represented in the U.S. Congress for 16 years, there will be increased pressure for him to drop out. He's now essentially neck and neck with Mitt Romney among Republican voters in Pennsylvania. Romney got endorsements this week from President George Herbert Walker Bush, Marco Rubio, and today Paul Ryan. But while candidates see the Keystone State as a political prize, there's not the same amount of political engagement among the public. And that's according to the 2011 Pennsylvania Civic Health Index that found that Pennsylvanians don't talk much with their family and friends about politics. Well, we do that a lot here on Radio Times, and I certainly do that with my family and friends. We're going to talk about Pennsylvania politics today on Radio Times, and we have two guests. Joining us by telephone is Chris Borick. He's an assistant professor of political science at Muhlenberg College, also director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. And Chris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, it's great to be on, Marty.
Also with us is Laura Brown, and she's a political science professor at Villanova University. Her latest book is called Jockeying for the American Presidency. She also serves on the board of the New Agenda, and that's a women's advocacy group aimed at fighting stereotypes of women in the media. And Laura Brown, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. And Laura, let me begin with you and begin with this index. And I think the most interesting finding was that something like 20% of people in this state of Pennsylvania discuss politics with their family or friends. As I said, that's not true in my house. It begins at about 5:30 in the morning, and it doesn't end until about 11 o'clock at night. But does that surprise you?
No, it actually doesn't surprise me, partly because I think Pennsylvania has a history of being a battleground state. This was once very much a party machine state, and you had party bosses like Matthew Kay and Simon Cameron, and these individuals in the late 1800s worked very hard to sort of mobilize and politicize the public, but it was still close. And this gets into that issue of how much do you really want to have a conversation with your friends that may be contentious.
What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, you know, I'm not that surprised either. I share the same view that Laura does. And for a little bit of a different reason, I think one of the reasons we might not be as engaged in politics is that Pennsylvanians have always had this pragmatic view of politics. What can it do for them? It's not a particularly ideological state. It's not one where I'd say there are robust extremes in either party in terms of ideology. It seems to be a how can this thing work for me type of mentality, which might not always create the greatest amount of dialogue. And also, to be honest, we've made it not so interesting to be a voter in Pennsylvania. We don't encourage. Almost everything we do in terms of our voting rules, our election systems, doesn't really encourage people to participate. We have, you know, a system where it's you can't vote in many primaries unless you're of those parties. Our system in getting registered is slow and cumbersome. We can't register on election day to be part of an election. You know, we have the longer waiting period. We don't have referendums. We don't have recalls. We don't have forms of direct democracy. Almost everything we do structurally doesn't really encourage engagement. And so when you look at the picture, some of this is maybe wrought by our own type of election system that we have in the Commonwealth.
Well, and just picking up on that, Laura, it's also difficult for a third-party candidate to get on a ballot in Pennsylvania.
Oh, absolutely. And this goes to exactly what Chris was saying about the rules and procedures within our elections. And you see that in a closed primary, if you are a liberal Republican or a moderate Democrat, who happen to be a lot of Pennsylvania voters, because I think Chris is right. You know, Pennsylvanians are pragmatic. They may be slightly conservative, but it's really more apt to call them traditional rather than, say, socially conservative. And I think one of the things that you see is that, you know, we have a rise in the number of independents in this country. You know, the last Gallup reading had about 40% of this country says that they consider themselves independents. There's nowhere to go in Pennsylvania if you fit into those categories.
But Laura, I'm also thinking of Philadelphia, which is essentially a one-party town. Does that also, do you think, discourage engagement and maybe even voting?
Well, I think Philadelphia actually fares pretty well at this level. You know, the study, as I recall, did show that African Americans are some of the most engaged Pennsylvanians in politics. And I think where you probably see more of this reticence is out in the suburbs, out by Villanova, the collar counties that are traditionally sort of swing counties in the state.
Well, and just picking up on that, Chris, the index found that of those who do talk about politics, they tend to be a bit older than 65 or older, college grads, and as Laura said, African Americans. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think, you know, almost all the evidence we have about political engagement does say that older Americans, and in our case, older Pennsylvanians, tend to be more involved in the political systems. They vote more. They read more about politics. They're more likely to follow what's going on. And the same as Laura said, and the study found. excuse me.
Okay.
African Americans. Do see themselves or talk politics more, and maybe again because a lot of the issues that are most relevant in terms of daily lives come into their conversations, which seep into politics. So I think when you look at who is engaged, it's probably not that surprising for what this particular study finds.
And I'm a bit older than both of you, but I mean, I was so influenced by the 60s. I mean, this was the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement. I'm looking at you, Laura. I mean, there was just a lot going on, not to say that everything worked out hunky-dory, but there was, as a young person, there was just so much to be engaged with.
Well, I think one of the things that is true, though, is that we keep having a lot of things going on. I mean, when I think about our history and I think about since I've really been, you know, a political scientist, I mean, my goodness, you know, the Bill Clinton winning was a big deal in 1992, a sense of change. A Democrat hadn't won for, you know, a number of years since 1976. You also saw, you know, a Republican revolution in 94, which for the first time in 40 years, the Congress moved Republican. We saw a presidential impeachment, a tied election, an attack on this country on 9/11. It really, in some ways, hasn't been all that boring. But I do think, because I see this with my students, they are less connected to the political world, partly because they are not involved with it as much. And what I mean by that is that they don't own property. Many of them are not yet working. Many of them are not paying high taxes, and most of them are not even paying for their schooling. And I think that when you look at those differences, you do see the younger generation less impacted by the political world.
And Chris, again, picking up on that, and you look at how the public views Congress, for instance, in very low esteem, I should say, I think probably in the single digits. And I don't know if that's new or not, but it seems to me if you don't think the system is working for you, why would you bother to talk about it?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I'll pick up on that. I'll pick one quick point on Laura's point about young people. I think the most fascinating thing about their lack of political engagement is that they do care and they do see relevance in service. That, you know, if we look on campuses, I'm sure it's at Villanova, I know it's at Muhlenberg and other places, our students are highly engaged in the communities. They do service, they do field research, they're out there. They don't see the connection between a lot of the problems that they deal with through service and politics. They see politics as adversarial, they see it as negative, they see it as something that they don't necessarily want to be involved with as much as they really care about. You know, if they're working in a shelter for battered women, they see the problems that face a group like that, but they don't necessarily make the connection that being involved in political issues is a way to solve or address those problems. And I think that goes back to your question, Marty, about cynicism for Congress. You know, we see the cynicism levels are about as high as they've ever been. If we look at the polls, there's always been you know, skepticism and cynicism about what happens in Washington, but those levels are deep, and that seeps in to the psyche and the level of interest that the public has, and of course among young people that's particularly acute.
Go ahead, Laura.
Oh, I just wanted to say, Chris, that's so true. I mean, our students at Villanova, it makes me laugh because the coolest club to be a part of is actually the committee that hosts our Special Olympics sort of participation and events on campus. And I think back to when I was in college, and I can tell you that certainly was not kind of the coolest thing to do, was to engage in service that way.
Let me get Michael from Philadelphia, who just called us up. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I had a quick question. If there was any research done that showed a correlation between actual, you know, participating in a political conversation with your family and actually getting out to the polls, because I myself grew up in a family where political discussion was encouraged, but I do not vote.
Oh, you don't vote? And Michael, just a quick reason why not?
I guess maybe a lot of discussion can really burn you out, I guess, you know?
Interesting. Well, I'm even going back to the index, Laura, and I'm looking at you as well. While in Pennsylvania, near the ranking 50th when it comes to discussing politics, pretty much in the middle, 35th when it comes to voter turnout. So it looks like there's not a cause and effect here necessarily.
Well, I think that's right. And I often describe politics to my students as being something of a soap opera. You can completely ignore it and not realize that you're missing anything. But once you tune in for about 10 days, it's pretty much addictive, and it's then, you know, must watch and continue to stay attuned. So I do agree that, you know, politics is conflictual and can be cynical. I think this is something that worries me a bit, though, because that's our system. Our system of separation of powers is about structuring a fight. It is not about creating, you know, civility and sort of niceness. So I think we've also lost a sense of really how contentious our system was originally created, so that we could work through the issues to eventually come to compromise.
And Chris, we got about 30 seconds before our break here. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, follow up on both Lars and Michael's call. You know, it is a good predictor still. If we're to see who will show up on election day, we often ask in our polls, one of the best things is, how closely are you following, or are you reading or watching news coverage and or in discussion? So engaging through non-voting means through these discussions is a good predictor for us of how much someone will probably end up actually voting in an election.
And that's Chris Borick. He's an assistant professor of political science at Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Laura Brown with us here in our Philadelphia studios, political science professor at Villanova University, also in Pennsylvania. Her latest book is Jockeying for the American Presidency. We are talking about Pennsylvania politics engagement. After this short break, we'll be talking about the primary, which is on April 24th, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
What happens when Henson puppeteers are unleashed? A new breed of intelligent nonsense that is stuffed and unstrung. A live, outrageous comedy variety show for adults only at the Grand in Wilmington, Thursday, April 12th. A motley group of characters, brought to life by the six expert puppeteers from the Jim Henson Company, improvise songs and sketches based on audience suggestions. For tickets to Stuffed and Unstrung, 837-GRAND or tickets at thegrand.org. The Grand supports WHYY.
On This American Roots, we follow two giants of jazz, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. From humble North Carolina beginnings to trials and triumphs in New York City, including conversations with McCoy Tyner, Randy Weston, Pharoah Sanders, and the next generation, T.S. Monk and Ravi Coltrane. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Sunday night at 6 on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center and Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham have been awarded 3-year terms of accreditation in radiation oncology by the American College of Radiology and the American Society for Radiation Oncology. This accreditation represents Fox Chase's commitment to the high level of quality, patient safety, and technical rigor as specified by national experts in the field. More at foxchase.org and foxchase.org/Buckingham. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about Pennsylvania politics, how the state is fitting into the presidential election this year. This reminder, the primary is April 24th, and our guests are Muhlenberg College's Chris Borick and Villanova University's Laura Brown. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Chris, let me go back to you, and I would like to shift gears and talk a bit about this upcoming primary, beginning with Rick Santorum. And about a month or so ago, according to some polls, he was doing very well in the state compared to Mitt Romney, and seems to have taken a nosedive in the last couple of weeks. Has that been your finding as well?
Yeah, that's exactly what the situation looks like. Marty, in February, most polls had him with a very comfortable lead over Romney among Republicans in the Commonwealth. In the latest polls, Franklin Marshall, Terry Madonis, folks came out with last week had the race a statistical dead heat, both of them gaining around 30% of the vote. And I think it's his fortunes in Pennsylvania among Republican voters are starting to mirror the national trends regarding his candidacy. I mean, in many ways, the energy and life of that campaign, I think, is starting to ebb quite a bit. And if it's failing in Pennsylvania and it's starting to erode here, it really does speak volumes about where that race is headed and the likelihood of going on much farther than Pennsylvania, if even at that point.
Well, and just to underscore what Chris just said, Laura, going back to the Franklin Marshall poll in February, it was Rick Santorum 45%, Mitt Romney 16%. The latest poll, 30% Santorum, 28% Mitt Romney. That's a precipitous fall in a very short period of time.
Well, it is, but I agree with Chris that I actually think both his rise and his fall are related to what his sort of standing was in the national electorate. I think it's important to understand that the more the national electorate and Pennsylvanians are sort of reminded of who Senator Rick Santorum was and how he campaigned in 2006, then they are reminding themselves that he's not really their candidate.
Well, and just to underscore what you just said, Laura, he lost big in 2006. Yes, he did represent Pennsylvania for 16 years in the U.S. Congress, but lost big to a well-known Pennsylvanian, Bob Casey.
And let me just say this, too, because I think it's interesting, right? Senator Santorum's campaign right now is saying, well, we really only lost in 2006 because of the giant wave against the Republicans that year. And yet, you have to understand that Santorum actually earned his seat in 1994, which was a Republican wave in favor of the Republicans, and yet Santorum only prevailed over Wofford by 2 percentage points, whereas he lost in 2006 by 18. So that sort of justification and number crunching doesn't really hold up to what the Santorum campaign is saying.
But this is what people get hired to do on a campaign. Yes, Laura?
Well, of course. But I do think
spin it in the best possible light.
But I think one of the things that's pretty profound is he lost moderates in 2006 by 44%. And while, you know, in a closed primary, you're not likely to see many of the Republicans turning out to actually identify as moderates, that is still a substantial percentage point loss. And if you compare it to something like George W. Bush in the 2004 presidential election, you saw a much more even split.
Let me go back to you, Chris, and ask you about how you think Mitt Romney will fare in Pennsylvania. Asking that, of course, knowing that while you may disagree with Rick Santorum, it seems that he is a true believer. I mean, that he has really staked out positions and has held to them. You cannot say the same thing about Mitt Romney.
No, I think that's a very fair point, Marty. And it does. I'll speak quickly about Santorum to kind of set up Romney, and you're actually right. We did a poll last month looking at Pennsylvania voters and how they viewed Rick Santorum. And we asked whole battery of questions about his views, his images. One of the most striking things was that the last time we polled Rick Santorum was right before Election Day on 2006 in the state. His approval numbers were identical to what we found last month.
Oh,
exactly identical. People hadn't changed in Pennsylvania their views on Rick Santorum. They were exactly where. He had about a 40% approval rating, about a 50% disapproval rating, or unfavorable rating. So they didn't change much. And what they said was they believe that Rick Santorum, what he says, he believes. They said his values he speaks truly about. What they also said was they don't agree with most of his beliefs and values, and that always makes it difficult. You know, they feel he's an honest individual in terms of saying what he thinks is in his heart and what he believes, but they don't necessarily share those beliefs. On the other hand, Mitt Romney is someone that I think individuals don't necessarily know what he believes, but in the end might be more comfortable with him as a candidate because they necessarily don't have the adversarial views about his positions. And so it puts him in a tricky position in the sense that people don't necessarily trust him, but it also gives him some advantages because there's some things that they don't necessarily feel passionately against. And I think that helps explain some of his electability advantages over Rick Santorum.
But he's such an interesting candidate, Lark, because I think you can legitimately say that he has been on both sides of important issues. I mean, just you don't get to be governor of Massachusetts if you're as conservative as he says he is today.
No, I mean, that's right. I think one of the things that has happened over both of these politicians' sort of political careers is that the Republican Party has continued to move further to the right. When, you know, Mitt Romney sort of got into Republican politics, the Republican Party had sort of a broader spectrum to which it appealed. Now conservatives are much more sort of narrow, and they have a greater desire for sort of fidelity to their issues. I think you can say that our former governor, Tom Ridge, probably also would not make it very far in Republican politics today.
But do you think when Mitt Romney's campaign strategist said, you know, when it comes to the general election, he's going to tack, I guess, towards the center, do you think that was an impolitic thing to say? Because as we know from previous campaigns, that's what the parties do, don't they? Isn't that what the candidates do?
That's precisely what the candidates do. But I think that one of the things that you see consistently with Romney's campaign is that there have been a number of these sort of almost too honest gaffes. You know, I keep thinking to myself, how is it that he sort of doesn't have more of an ability to bob and weave when he is thought to be such a flexible politician? So that question sort of vexes me.
Oh, does it vex you as well, Chris?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that's interesting, and I like the reaction. It's absolutely what general election candidates do. We know that. You just never say that, especially. I mean, what was so difficult for the Romney campaign is, given the public image and the criticism of him as not having a true, you know, compass, if you will, the idea that he could just shake it up, and also, you know, from a political perspective, give such an easy, accessible point to demonstrate exactly the negatives that he has regarding his lack of commitment to issues. So it was a very big blunder. But again, you know, as this blunder has gone on, everybody said, well, you know, that might be calling attention to it. I think that the overall wave of momentum now that we see to Mitt Romney with endorsements like George H.W. Bush and even Tea Party favorites like Marco Rubio from Florida give us a sense that even with these liabilities, the party is coalescing around him, and that you know, we'll go through the remainder of these primaries, but the writing's becoming more and more apparent on the wall.
You agree with that, Laura?
Well, I do, and I also think that there are some similarities and some parallels, if but a mirror reflection of it, in the 2004 Democratic race. You could see that Howard Dean was certainly representing the progressive wing. He called himself, right, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, and John Kerry was tacking a more middle ground, and then obviously in the general election, George W. Bush made great use of sort of his flip-flop image.
Literally flip-flop, etch-a-sketch. Apparently sales just go crazy when those things are uttered. That's Laura Brown. She's a political science professor at Villanova University. Chris Bork joining us by telephone, assistant professor of political science at Muhlenberg College. And we are talking about Pennsylvania politics, the upcoming primary here in Pennsylvania on April 24th. And we're interested in what you're making of the race, the candidates, the issues. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to, looks like Lisa from Delaware to join our conversation. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Calling from Northern Delaware, and I am a former Pennsylvania resident, so this topic is interesting to me.
Good.
And I just, since you have political science professors on the line, I want to tell you that I am a middle-aged woman who's been very interested in politics all my life. I used to beg my parents to stay up way past my bedtime to watch the conventions. But that was before there were primaries in states as little and inconsequential as the state of Delaware.
Huh.
Not even a million people live in this state, and yet we have a primary. What is up with that?
Well, that's
it forces people to choose a party. I am an independent because although I am politically affiliated, I have never, ever, ever voted a straight ticket. And I can't believe that I'm the only person in the United States of America who is like that. But I want to participate in the political process, and the only way you can do that these days is to choose a political party.
And then you get the primary to vote in. Lisa, that's a really interesting comment. Let me give Laura a chance to weigh in, and then we'll get Chris in on it as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, historically, what is actually interesting, let me pick up on sort of your first point. Why do we have primaries and we don't have these contentious, contested sort of national conventions? It's because originally it was believed back in the early 1900s that the conventions were so much about political insiders pulling strings that progressives, Woodrow Wilson being one of the really sort of advocates of this, pushed forward with the idea that people in the state should be able to choose. And it wasn't until essentially the McGovern-Fraser reforms, which were implemented beginning in 1972, where we saw the delegates starting to have sort of a binding connection to the vote in the state. But really, prior to that time, it still was political insiders. So how do I say this? I guess primaries were created to allow more openness, and yet because they are still sort of events that are controlled and run by political parties, they are still insider events.
And leaving Lisa out in the cold, as she describes it. Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think a great history. The Laura said that the primaries were designed to incorporate the average voter much more than in the past in the closed conventions. How well they do that, I think, is a reasonable question to ask, given the structure of the system, the unbelievably convoluted rules that govern the process and the association of delegates to the convention, that even the most ardent follower of politics would be hard pressed to understand, and then add the dimension of the closing of the ability to vote to people that are registered with the parties, and it does induce we talked earlier in the program a lack of interest and engagement. Now on behalf of speaking for the parties, you could make a case that, well, we are choosing a party candidate, therefore it should be the individuals of the party that have a say, and I think that's a reasonable point to make. But looking more broadly beyond party interest, the lack of ability of many, many voters to cast any ballot that chooses who's going to be on a presidential slate is troubling from a broader democratic point of view. small d.
Small d. Yeah, go ahead, Laura.
Well, I think, you know, this is where one of my favorite quotes from Duke professor John Aldrich. He's a political scientist. He's written a book called Why Parties. And one of my favorite quotes from him is, sure, anybody can grow up to be president of the United States so long as they grow up to be one of the major party nominees. And I think that that quote embodies precisely the problem for people who are independent, who are more moderate, who are sort of upset and have a sense of sort of alienation from the polarization that's occurred recently, because it just shows that you can't get there unless you play the party politics.
Well, let me add something else to it, which is the amount of money that is being spent. Now, we haven't been hit yet with, you know, round-the-clock advertising on campaign, Laura, as the primary approaches. But nonetheless, you know, millions and millions of dollars being spent now more by super PACs than even the candidates or even the parties.
And, of course, that was a result, really, of the McCain-Feingold reform, which was supposed to actually get rid of soft money in politics.
But nonetheless, yes, we know who these groups are, but we really don't know very much about them, except that many of them have worked for the candidates that they supposedly are not coordinating with.
Oh, absolutely. And this is where, you know, Senator Mitch McConnell actually had this right during the debate back in 2002. He essentially said that we didn't get soft money out of politics. It just changed addresses.
Chris, you want to I'm sure you have some thoughts here. Yes, go ahead.
It's pretty simple. I mean, it's about as horrific a system as you could find for financing elections. It's, you know, when we're thinking about the amount of money spent already just on this race, it's well in, you know, over $80 million just in the primaries alone. And we're going to be speaking of record amounts this year, and record amounts from concentrated individuals and groups, not widely dispersed. You know, money would be one thing if it was, you know, coming from many, many people spread out across the electorate. We could have a different debate there. But the idea that so much of the money being spent right now is coming from a concentrated few should trouble anybody that's interested in a vibrant and healthy democracy. It's a poor system that has become poorer since the Citizens United case.
Well, and do you think, Laura, goes back to Citizens United or it goes back to just how we finance
It actually goes
elections?
Back to the fact that the McCain-Feingold law, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, basically said that the parties could no longer collect soft money. And prior to that time, these wealthy individuals who are now creating these super PACs would essentially give to the party. The party would then have certain types of spending that they could use that money on. So, for instance, Chaim Saban, who basically is the person behind Power Rangers and is a very wealthy Democratic donor out in Los Angeles, he gave $7 million to the Democratic Party to help them actually purchase their sort of building in Washington, D.C., so they wouldn't have to continue paying a lease. So did Mr. Saban have, you know, influence with the Democrats? You bet. But as Chris suggested, it was filtered through the party. Now it's just direct to the candidate.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation talking about politics today in Radio Times, Pennsylvania style. Laura Brown and Chris Borick, our guests. We do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Catholic Charities Appeal supports WHYY. How did you feel the last time you helped someone in need? It felt good, didn't it? Helping others always does. Catholic Charities Appeal gives help and hope to those who need it. With over 80 programs that offer food, clothes, shelter, and proper care to the homeless, hungry, disadvantaged youth, and developmentally delayed, we make a difference in the lives of so many. Learn how to help at CatholicCharitiesAppeal.org. That's CatholicCharitiesAppeal.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Earl Scruggs. He died Wednesday at the age of 88. He developed his famous three-finger style while absentmindedly playing the banjo one day.
When I realized what I was doing, I was playing the way that I play now. It was like having a dream and wake up, you're actually playing the tune.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Maintenance fees for savings accounts, charges for statements sent through the mail. We'll look at how banks are charging customers for things that used to be free. Also, India calls itself the world's largest democracy, so why is it jailing Tibetan demonstrators? Could it have something to do with its big next-door neighbor? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Here's a little factoid. Three of the four Republican presidential candidates have ties to Pennsylvania. Ron Paul was born in western Pennsylvania, Newt Gingrich in central Pennsylvania, and of course Rick Santorum represented the state in the U.S. Congress for 16 years. I read about that recently in Politically Uncorrect Today, a column that comes out of Franklin and Marshall College, and also a Franklin and Marshall College poll found that the Keystone State has Rick Santorum's popularity in the state has taken a nosedive in the last month. We are talking about presidential politics, Pennsylvania politics, and our guests are Chris Borick of Muhlenberg College and Laura Brown of Villanova University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Nancy from Bucks County to join our conversation. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. I'm
wondering if either guest is seeing hyperpartisanship in local politics. For example, in our central Bucks County, we have the third largest school district, and our school board refuses to have even a conversation with engaged citizens. They're not giving substantive reasons for changes being made. They're basically stonewalling. So is this related at all to the lack of the power of recall?
Well, that's interesting, and I'm looking at you, Laura. Do you think hyperpartisanship, as our caller described it, has, in a sense, sort of infected our whole political system?
Well, I think the hyperpartisanship is happening broadly and nationally. I mean, I think one of the things that you see is you can look at these polls on health care. I mean, it pretty much comes down to the fact that if you're a Republican, you're against this national health care reform. If you're a Democrat, you're for it. And this sense that, you know, what your party affiliation is, judges or biases all of your actions. Mm. And I think that is a problem in our political world. But I would also argue that this isn't necessarily new. What is new is that more and more people seem to have kind of this dedicated ideological viewpoint that does seem to be more extreme than ever.
You think so, Chris?
Yeah, I do. I love that last point that Laura made about the ideology coming into the local debates and discussions. One of the interesting things that we've seen over the last few years, and it might be described as hyperpartisanship, is that broader ideological arguments and debates seem to be creeping into local decision-making. Maybe it's land use, for example, decisions on zoning and other matters. There's been a much greater influence by individuals going to these meetings to represent an interest that would be called, you know, ideologically to the right, for example, saying that any land use regulations or restrictions in the interest of environmental regulations, for example, or even as far reaching as climate change, are seen as partisan in nature and against ideological viewpoints. So I think the rhetoric and some of the discussions that we might see at the local level are taking on more ideologically and partisan attributes than they might have been in the past.
But do you think, Chris, that conservatives are just more organized, more active?
Well, a lot of those type of things have absolutely come from an organized effort. I mean, we've seen, and as political tides turn, and especially in the last few years, as Republicans have taken over some legislative branches or executive and legislative branches in the states and at local levels and on county councils and and boroughs and townships, there has been more of an effort to have a coherent approach to what I would call seize the moment, mm-hmm. to say, okay, we have advantage right now in terms of being the majority party in a lot of these offices and institutions, and let's push through an agenda. And we've seen that in state legislatures in terms of reproductive rights issues, taxation policy issues, a lot of areas where the irons, I guess, are hot, and let's strike now.
Well, but isn't that what President Obama did, Laura, when he got into office? He had a majority in both houses of Congress and pushed through, or certainly tried to push through, a lot of legislation.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what President George W. Bush did in 2004, right after that election. I think one of the things that is true is that the parties are, if you will, attempting to spend their political capital quickly, probably because they don't necessarily think they're that electorally safe. We have had many elections now, sort of our last four elections have pretty much gone back and forth. They've been wave elections, which are not always sort of the usual norm in our politics. And this is part of the reason why, I've talked a lot about this period of time looks an awful lot like the 1890s, which is really what led to the rise of essentially the progressives. And in my mind, I see it as also what is leading to the rise of sort of the Tea Party sentiment that has been out there.
But I wanted to, just picking up what Chris said about some of these, so-called women's issues, you look at legislatures across the country trying to pass legislation related to contraception and abortion. But there seems to also be, Laura, a pushback where, yes, these bills were introduced, but then it seemed to engender some kind of a protest from certain women's groups or certain women as well.
Well, I think one of the things that is frustrating at some level is that, let's be honest, women tend to make up about 51% to 52% of any electorate that you're looking at. So the idea that all women agree on all issues is really a fairly naive viewpoint. I do think what you saw was that early on in a lot of these political debates, the more liberal or progressive women were engaged and active in politics. What we have seen really, and I would attribute some of this to Governor Palin, but also some of it to President George W. Bush's 2004 strategy, which focused on a notion of security moms, that we are now seeing women who are conservative and Republican becoming more engaged too.
Let me get, looks like Dick from Langhorne to join our conversation. And Dick, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I think that the one of the biggest problems is that the two major political parties have been hijacked by the most extreme people, and it's partly due to the fact that there are more and more independents, so that there are fewer and fewer moderates, if you will, in either political party. And since the primaries are nominating the candidates, we tend to end up with much more extreme candidates, and therefore you've got a choice between electing a very left-leaning Democrat or a very extreme right-wing Republican.
Well, let me give that to Chris Borg. And Dick, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Chris, your thoughts?
I think Dick is right. I think there's evidence to show that. One of the interesting aspects of our, if you look at Congress right now, a couple of political scientists track the ideological ratings of Democrats and Republicans, and there's always been some crossover, right? The most conservative Democrat was more conservative than the most liberal Republican, right? There was a few crossover points between, and in this cycle, this election, this Congress, that's not the case. The most conservative Democrat is still more liberal than the most liberal Republican, and there's a number of factors that I think contribute to that. One is, as Dick said, the primary system. The closed primary systems, we speak to the more extreme individuals in our party, and we can't get that crossover that independent who might be moderately conservative is not going to vote in that campaign, and therefore more conservative or on the opposite side, more liberal candidates will win on the Democratic side. And the second is something I've been on the show and talked about and I harp on over and over, our congressional elections and how we do it through our congressional districting, Pennsylvania being the prime example. We gerrymander them to the point where we take out competition And it's hard to do in a state like Pennsylvania that is naturally competitive when you look at our demographics. But we find a way to do it, make it less and less competitive. And that breeds extremism in the types of candidates that we have. Even in this cycle, you look at some of the districts we've created that used to be more moderate, like the 15th Congressional District up in the Lehigh Valley. It's been moved, become a much more safer for Charlie Dent, who used to be fairly moderate. It opens the door for him to be less so as we go on. So I think structurally we produce some of the outcomes that we're seeing.
And we get to redistrict every 10 years based on the census. Laura, you want to add to that?
Oh, I just completely agree with everything that Chris said. I mean, especially when it comes to congressional elections, you know, we now have a House of Representatives that does not represent the median point of the American people. It actually represents the median point of the majority party. So inevitably, if the Democrats are in control, it's going to be to the left of the country, and fairly far to the left. If the Republicans are in control, it will be far to the right of the American people. And I think this is part of why you're seeing these wave elections where there's sort of this, let's throw the bums out, because no matter what they're doing, they're sort of governing from their extremes.
But do you think in the end that is not going to work? That when you look at how people feel about most issues, they're probably somewhere in the middle, if they think about them at all.
Yes, I think that's right. And I also think this is where California is engaged in a very interesting sort of experiment. They did both create essentially a redistricting commission that has now created somewhat more competitive districts this time around. They also happen to have created and passed via referendum a measure that allows for the top two winners in the primary to actually fight against each other. Sure. So there is a district right now that looks like you could end up where essentially an independent may win that district, because that independent would actually be battling against a Democrat rather than a necessary Democrat and Republican on the ballot.
Interesting. Let me see what Samantha from Ardmore has to say. And Samantha, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of come back around to the caller from Delaware and the guy from Langhorne about primaries. I've lived in about six states. I left PA in the early 90s, came back 2010, back to the state, and I had just moved down from Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, out of all the states that I lived in, was the only one that had an open primary system where I could actually register as a nonpartisan. And I'd get an open ballot at primary time and whatever election it was. So how do we get an open primary system to allow for more competition, so to speak, besides the gerrymandering question? And I just wondered what the two political science people thought about that.
Well, me as well. And it seems, Chris, that you would be up against the political party system, yes?
you called it, Marty. It's the party. Parties control the primaries right now. I mean, for lack of a better term, it's their show, it's their dance, it's their party. Any changes really have to come from within the party structure to make it happen. And as you can guess, Pennsylvania's political parties, both Democrats and Republicans have been very reticent to want to adopt any reforms that might undercut or allow individuals outside of the party to have an influence on outcomes. And so I wish I could give you promising news on that front that we might see some changes, but I really wouldn't hold my breath or your breath.
And or Laura's breath?
No, definitely not. I agree. I mean, one of the things that you see is these types of process sort of reforms typically do happen in states that have more open rules. That's why California, given its initiative and referendum and recall provisions, are able to pass these sort of over the heads of the state legislature, if you will. And I think, you know, one of the other things, just going back to Massachusetts versus Pennsylvania, is that you see that in a state where there is such a sort of strong one party, there's also not as much fear about essentially the opposition party gaining, you know, a little bit of votes or independents engaging with the system. In a state like Pennsylvania, where that competition is fierce, the parties both actually kind of work together to make sure that it stays within their control.
And Chris, a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, but looking ahead to the April 24th primary in Pennsylvania, when do you think the battle begins?
Oh, well, it's begun in its early skirmishes, if you will. But you're going to see in the next 2 weeks, and I'm so fascinated, Marty, to see if Mitt Romney goes for the death blow, if you will. You know, if the race is still competitive by the time we get here, and Santorum is still relevant, it really is this opportunity for Romney to knock him out. Simply put, if Santorum loses Pennsylvania, any credible argument he has to bring to a convention that he could win key states is gone. And so I'm interested to see how much money he puts in terms of ad time in Pennsylvania. My feeling is that he's going to go all in here, that he being Romney, and you'll start seeing a serious array of ads in the next 2 weeks.
You agree with that, Laura?
You know, I'm not sure, only in the sense that, you know, Mitt Romney's campaign thus far has sort of consistently pulled its punches. There are times where it had opportunities to kind of go all in and end this. And so what I'm kind of curious to see is actually whether they're going to be a little bit cautious in the hopes that it will be easier to pull over Santorum's supporters later and essentially let Santorum fall on his own sword.
But are you saying that there are risks of going too negative?
Absolutely. You could see right after Florida, right, there was this sort of rejection of Romney by a lot of Gingrich's supporters who were so upset, you know, that Gingrich had been so attacked. So I think that there is a level at which, you know, these candidates kind of walk a fine line. You got to hit this knockout punch, and at the same time, you don't want to so anger or upset these individuals that they don't turn out for you in November.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of weeks. Laura Brown, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Chris Borick, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Chris Borick, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Muhlenberg College, Director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Laura Brown, as I said, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Political Science Professor at Villanova University, author most recently of Jockeying for the American Presidency. She also serves on the board of the New Agenda, and that's a women's advocacy group aimed at fighting stereotypes of women in the media. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.